We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. You know, in recent years, art museums in this country and elsewhere have had to confront an increasing number of claims that works that they hold in their collections had been subject to theft or to forced sale during the Nazi era around World War II. And this morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be looking at some of the ways that museums have dealt with these claims. And our guest is Jennifer Crater. She is Associate Professor of Law at Northern Kentucky University, and she's an expert on legal issues affecting the international art market. And she argues that actually some museums have used legal technicalities to block requests for restitution of looted art, when really what they should be doing is defending the requests on the historical merits. We'll talk a little bit about that. This is a subject that she is here on the campus to talk about. And in fact, we'll be giving a talk tonight, and this is taking place at the Spurlock Museum in the Knight Auditorium. That's on South Gregory in Urbana. She'll give her talk at 7. There is no charge for admission. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Just let me tell you a little bit more about her before she got into academics. She worked at a law firm in New York where she concentrated on Holocaust-era litigation issues, art disputes, class actions. She also was awarded for her work on behalf of Catholic nuns and others who were tortured and murdered during the Salvadoran Civil War. She's participated in State Department efforts to create a Nazi-looted art commission and currently serves as co-chair of the American Society of International Law's Cultural Heritage and the Arts Interest Group. And she's written widely on the subject, and we're pleased that she could be here on the program to talk with us. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. You may also send us your questions by email, and the address for that is will-talks, that's just like it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So how is it that you got into this particular area of law?
Well, when I practiced up in New York, as you mentioned, I worked on Holocaust litigation. And when that litigation started to wind down to a significant degree, I followed my dream, which was to teach. And so as I was going into academia, you have to pick an area that you're going to write in and really mm-hmm. specialize in. And so I thought at the time that art really hadn't been handled at the diplomatic level in the way that so many of the other claims had been. So we had slave and forced labor, class actions that were filed, insurance claims, bank account claims, gold claims. And many of those had been dealt with effectively by the signing of treaties and then creation of new commissions over in Europe that would then compensate survivors. But there was no commission created for art. And mm-hmm. so I figured at the time that there would come a time where we would have to deal with this. So when I went into academia, I started to really drill down into the subject area, and here we are. And so mm-hmm. the time has arrived.
So if you just confine yourself to museums in the United States, I'm sure mm-hmm. that private collections is a whole another matter, and international is another matter. So if you just say, well, from what we know about museums in the United States, how many pieces do you think there are that are in museum connections where someone has made a claim or there might be the possibility of making a claim?
Well, nobody agrees on the numbers. So I really can't confine myself to the United States to answer your question.
Oh, okay.
But if you go back to 1998, there was some consensus around the number 100,000 objects of significant value that were still missing since the war. And others debate that the number is actually significantly higher. And if we were to add in objects of lesser value in terms of financial value, and then if you add in objects of Judaica and other things, the number would explode, in my opinion. Mm. But I am not a historian. I'm a law professor. So as far as the numbers, there isn't a consensus, I would say. But if you go to the law firm of Herrick Feinstein, there's a fantastic document that they maintain there, and it's if you go to the Art Law Group and then you look under publications, there's a chart that law firm maintains of resolved stolen art claims. Mm-hmm. So and that may be resolved negatively or positively in terms of restitution. And they also keep track of whether litigation was necessary in order to secure the return. And of course, everything's not public. There are plenty of quiet settlements. And I would say that the quiet settlements greatly outnumber the ones that we hear about, yeah. Which is a good thing. That means that the system is probably working. But there's an awful lot of evidence that during the war and after the war, a lot of the artwork came here. Europe was occupied. The Nazis were using auctions in Switzerland to raise currency. There is significant evidence that people from the United States went over to those auctions and bought paintings there. And that's just the official auction way that paintings and other objects could arrive in the United States. And certainly there was plenty of smuggling. As of 1964, the United States had seized over 4,000 objects here in the United States. Mm. And we're seeing a lot of litigation now, and a lot of it's going to surround the time period of 1933 to 1935 before the first race law was passed, but not all of it. So there's a lot of fighting of paintings that were taken even after 1935 that are in our museums, and that some of our museums bought as late as 1938 or 1939 during the war and then after the war.
Yeah. It's really when you and I know one doesn't merely want to talk about this in terms of money, mm-hmm. by placing dollar amounts on things, because that's not the only way to determine the value of something. But simply if you look at that, and if you look at the restitutions that have been made already, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars worth of art, and it sounds as if that's just a small.
We're talking about billions of dollars worth, yeah. of art. That estimate of 100,000 objects often was put hand in hand with an estimate of $20.5 billion worth of art. Mm-hmm. And that's just of what we classify as significant value.
Yeah. And is there some particular reason why, and it's my impression that in recent years, and I suppose really we're talking about maybe the last 10 years, there has been an increase in the numbers of claims. Is there, assuming that I'm right about it, is there something that has been going on that has led to this big increase in claims?
Yeah, certainly. And it's tied in with the rise in claims, not just for art, but for all sorts of other things, including slave and forced labor. Mm-hmm. Shortly after the war, there was a document that was signed that was called the London Debt Agreement. And how it's been read, and this I think is solidified at this point, was that it put a freeze on claims. Because after the war, our focus turned from, whereas after World War I, we wanted reparations. And that was viewed historically as part of the contributing environment for the rise of the Nazi party. After World War II, the focus changed. We were concerned about the Soviet sphere of influence expanding all the way to the Atlantic. We shifted to the Marshall Plan. We had the London Debt Agreement so that claims were frozen and individual claims weren't resolved directly after the war. Some were. There were mechanisms where some people could claim after the war. But you have to remember, people's lives were completely destroyed and families torn apart, people murdered, documents. Some did survive, sure, but not everybody had access to that information. A lot of the information was hidden in archives. If people even had the ability to go and search for it, I mean, a lot of people couldn't even find their family members, much less property. Mm. So some tenacious families were able to recover property after the war, certainly. But for the most part, people were refugees in foreign lands and had to get on with their lives. And the prospects for restitution after the war were grim. You know, we now have a lot of information about scandalous activities in various countries after the war that completely hindered restitution. In Austria, after the war, we know that there were a lot of people who were forced to give up rights to certain property in order to get export permits for other property. And at that time, the idea that Austria was the first victim of Hitlerite aggression was still the permeating view. Mm-hmm. So after the war, prospects for restitution were grim. So after the London Debt Agreement expired, that's when you saw all of these class actions filed in the mid-90s that people saw about, you know, that people read about in the press. And then during the Clinton administration, most of those were dealt with effectively by a treaty. But again, the art wasn't dealt with. And then we had the seizure in New York of Portrait of Wally. And it created an uproar. And it was seized at the state, at the New York state level, in 1998, and then that the subpoena to seize the painting was quashed, and then the United States government stepped in and seized it at the national level. So that seizure really put this issue back on the national agenda and the international agenda as being a legally viable option to actually get back art. And these claims are viable, and I think that that's lost on a lot of people. Under common law jurisprudence, the idea that one cannot get title from a thief is the dominating view. And there are some exceptions, but they are not present in these cases. Mm. Now, time bar doctrines like statute of limitations might prevent a claim, but the discovery rule, which is in place in most there are some variations, but in most jurisdictions throughout the United States, the discovery rule provides that the statute of limitations time period doesn't start to tick until a claimant is on notice of the claim, of where the painting might be, and who the party might be to sue. And then when you go and you look at some of the cases, I think inherent in this idea is that you have a forum where you could actually bring the claim. Mm-hmm. And so that forum, to a large degree, was missing for a long time. And then you have survivors dying, and their heirs don't always know all of the information to actually be able to go and assert a claim. So do we apply the discovery rule today as if the survivors are completely in the same shoes? As if the heirs are completely in the same shoes as the survivors, when maybe they never even had access to key information. Mm-hmm. And even the survivors themselves didn't always have all of the information. A lot of times that information died in the Holocaust.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for this hour of the show, Jennifer Crater. She's professor of law at Northern Kentucky University and is here visiting the campus. She's going to give a talk, and that's tonight, talking about Nazi-looted art in U.S. museums, something that she's done a lot of writing about. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I have a caller here and I want to get to, but I want to come back to a point that you mentioned, a point of law, and I'm sure that it's probably something that law professors could talk about for a long time. But that is that the basic idea, and it's certainly my understanding, is the basic idea is that one cannot have clear title to an item that is stolen, even if you bought it in good faith. It does not matter. Stolen goods are stolen goods. At the same time, though, I think that it is true that some museums have actually said, "Well, no, wait a minute, we're not so sure about that." And with something that's been stolen, sometimes provenance is difficult to establish, particularly if it's passed through the hands of several people. Is it the case that at some places, at some museums, they're really challenging this notion that you can't have clear title to stolen goods?
Well, you will see some of those arguments being made in the court documents, but where the museums are now defeating claims is on statute of limitations grounds, which is a different issue. Uh-huh. So title may not have passed, but this claimant can't actually go forward in court. Now, what that leaves open and what's happening, what happened in the Wally case and what has recently happened on behalf, effectively, of the Polish government in connection with two paintings that had been stolen that were done by Julian Falat. The U.S. government can still step in and seize stolen property. We have the National Stolen Property Act, which gives the government that authority when property has been moved in interstate commerce and exceeds the value of $5,000. We also have plenty of customs regulations that are violated when paintings are brought into the country illegally or if they're stolen goods. So, yes, if you go and you read the museum documents, they will say, you know, at the time that this painting was purchased, it was purchased in this country and this law applies and this law may have allowed title to pass. Now, I have seen so many different expert opinions about what French law says and what Swiss law says that, frankly, I couldn't even tell you what it actually says because it, the opinions are biased. And so a court faced with these polar opposite opinions as to what the law says has to make a choice right now in our system and say, okay, well, it maybe it applies or maybe it doesn't apply. And then if it does apply, what indeed does it say? But what the museums are winning on isn't on the title issue. It's on the statute of limitations. And what's so sad about that is that our government led the world to hold a conference in Washington, D.C. in 1998 and come up with the Washington Principles, which lay out guidelines. And they are non-binding. It's soft law. But they lay out guidelines, and they really depend on the cooperation of the museums. And those guidelines provide that art should be identified where there's a gap in the ownership history or the provenance, that these documents should be, you know, that we have about provenance should be open to the public to go ahead and research so that the pre-war owners can come forward and actually assert claims. And then it says that the museum should reach just and fair solutions. And that contemplates the fact that sometimes the documentation can be ambiguous. But what I think a lot of people fail to realize is that the Nazi Party was obsessed with legality, and even if it meant sending someone to Dachau to break down the resistance in order to get them to sign a power of attorney to give the spouse authority to liquidate the property, which then was systematically expropriated or Aryanized, and then when there was no need for the family anymore, the family was exterminated. And that's the surrounding context that we need to view a lot of these signed contracts. They are not voluntary. They're no more voluntary than if somebody had a gun to the person's head. So we have the Washington Principles that say, you know, that this we should be cooperating and we shouldn't be punishing claimants who come forward and say that they may have a claim. And then in 2009, we had a follow-up to that conference. There were also other follow-ups, but 2009 is the one I want to highlight, the Terezin Declaration, which expressly states that in addition to those wonderful cooperation principles, that claims should be resolved based on the facts and merits of the claims, not on the fact that time has passed. If we allow the property to remain where it is just because time has passed, I don't see any ethical grounds to back that up or moral grounds. And we can't allow the law to operate in that way. That's just fundamentally wrong.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. This is someone who's listening in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'd like to sort of broaden the conversation. I don't know if the guest would like to talk about these two matters, but one is there was recently some articles in the New York Times and elsewhere about a collection of religious writings in the Soviet Union. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but this links up with the art issues that are in the Soviet Union that were adjudicated in the Soviet Union as belonging to a particular Hasidic group, the Chabad or Schneerson, and there was a court ruling that in the Soviet Union that these belonged to him, but then the Soviet Union fell apart and the Russian government has seized these books, I don't know, it's 40,000, 50,000, and said, no, we're not going to give it to you. And there's now a case in the U.S. courts about this, and because of that, there have been problems with art loans to the United States museums because of fear that the U.S. government or U.S. courts would put a lien on them. So I wonder if you could talk about that matter. And then there's another issue. There's a U.S. congressman, I believe, or might be a senator who's from Florida, who's bringing a bill about insurance claims against European insurance companies by survivors or their descendants, and whether the U.S. courts can enforce those claims. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. So I'll listen on the air to your comments about it. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Well, thanks very much for the questions. I'm not as familiar with both of them. I'm familiar with them in the surface sense, and I'm actually going to be learning more about both of those issues at the end of the month. But what I can talk about first is when a museum in the United States wants to borrow an object from an overseas source, what it can do is can apply for an immunity from seizure certificate. And that means the painting can't be, if it's granted, the painting can't be seized while it's here. And the government would allow for some public commentary in the course of deciding whether to actually grant that certificate. Now, just because it can't be seized, however, doesn't mean that sending the object into the United States can't be an essential link to actually establish jurisdiction over the foreign lending institution. So I think that there is some discomfort right now overseas with lending objects, but I don't see that as necessarily a bad thing. In the past, the United States was viewed as being a beacon of justice in the Holocaust restitution movement. And right now, I think that we're at a pivotal point where that ability to serve that function is not what it once was. So we have court cases. If I can return to the art area, which is what I'm most familiar with, but we have cases right now pending in the courts, and the Supreme Court may take a look at one or more of them. And those cases have unfortunately laid a pattern where since 2004, there's only been one case won by a Holocaust victim or heir in federal court. And that case, the facts were so egregious. And I know that that only shows part of the picture because we have plenty of cases settled out of court and maybe even before anybody gets to court. But the fact that maybe some people will decide not to loan an object to the United States because it has a shady past. I wish they would send it here because I think if it has a shady past, it should be dealt with. But that doesn't trouble me. The idea that maybe, we don't get to see that art in our public institutions doesn't bother me at all. I actually think that taking a stand against financing genocide is a much stronger conversation and a much stronger statement that a museum could make by not accepting those kinds of works for loan. And museum ethics guidelines dictate that before museums acquire or even borrow, that they should investigate what the ownership history is. And then as far as the insurance claims, there is still pending litigation over that. There was an entity created that was headed by Paul Volcker over in Switzerland, and its job was to resolve all of these insurance claims that were still pending since the war. And there's been a lot of criticism of the institution. I believe the abbreviations are ICHEIC. Insurance Commission of Holocaust Era No, International Commission of Holocaust Era Insurance Claims, I believe it is. And a lot of that criticism has been about the small number of claims that have been awarded funds and the large expenses that the institution has incurred in trying to research claims. And I'm not involved in any of that litigation. And I know that there were some people who brought suits in the United States to try to get United States courts back in on the issue effectively. And a lot of that has been shut down, but there is potential for that to change, and we'll see what happens. But the insurance issues have been dealt with quite differently than art.
We're at a midpoint here in this hour of focus. Our guest is Jennifer Crater. She is Associate Professor of Law at Northern Kentucky University and has done a lot of writing and speaking on legal issues affecting the international art market. And she is visiting the campus and will be giving a talk on Nazi-looted art and U.S. museums at the Spurlock Museum. And that's taking place tonight, 7 o'clock, in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum, 600 South Gregory in Urbana, 7 o'clock. Anyone interested should feel welcome to attend. And if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana and you've never been to the Spurlock Museum, well, you should go because it's a lovely museum and one of the great treasures of the campus, and something that I think a lot of people don't even know about or maybe have not been. And they're getting ready to celebrate their centennial, so it's a good reason to go. And questions here are welcome, certainly, on this program. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and also email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let me ask you about maybe a different set of issues as far as museums are concerned. And this has to do with what in the technical term is deaccessioning. That's the word that people in museums use. There are museums have to abide by certain principles and certain regulations about getting rid of things. And they cannot simply look at a painting and say, well, we don't really like that very much anymore, and we could sell these paintings here and get millions of dollars and put that into operating our museum. They can't do that, at least not in that capricious a manner. And also, you know, they would argue that, well, they have certain fiduciary responsibilities and have to deal with the material that they own in a very responsible way. I'm sure that there are museums that say that those realities put limitations on our ability to respond to the kind of claims that we're talking about. Do you have any sort of sympathy for that?
Frankly, no. If a painting has been stolen, the museum, by possessing it, is actually committing a crime under the National Stolen Property Act. So the idea that it would harm the public trust, which I'm not even sure that there truly is one. I understand that we all benefit from museums, and I love museums. But the idea that that an institution cannot give up a painting that to which it does not have title because it would harm the collection is simply false. A museum, by possessing stolen property, is committing a crime under the National Stolen Property Act. Assuming all the other factors are met. I mean, the painting crossed a state line, right? It came into the country, obviously. So no, I don't have any sympathy for that argument. I understand that museums need to be careful. I understand that the provenance research can be quite complex, but one of the things that's happening right now, especially with the museums going into court to shut down claimants, is we're chopping off the ability to discover what truly happened with the painting. As, you know, we get little snippets of information that come out from time to time, but we're only scratching the surface of historical truth in terms of what has happened with massive quantities of property. And that's not only just art, but massive quantities of property. And so if we shut down the ability to get information, and some museums aren't even turning over the information that they do have. So, for example, the Museum of Modern Art in New York refused to even turn over documents from its files. And it managed to get a claim shut down on statute of limitations grounds before discovery, the process of exchanging information in a lawsuit, even was able to open up. So the law doesn't suit these claims well. And when the museums go to court and file the, what are called declaratory judgment actions in order to shut down the claimants, it's taking advantage of the fact that the law doesn't suit these claims well. And everybody knows this, right? All the lawyers know this. And that's why we had the Washington conference, and that's why we had the Terezin International Conference as well.
When, as you mentioned, establishing provenance can be complicated, and I'm sure that it can also be expensive.
Yes.
Who is required to bear the cost? That whoever is the current holder of the piece, or are the claimants?
Well, if someone's going to go to court, that person's going to have enough information to make a colorable claim. And you don't want to go to court unless you have much more than that. Mm-hmm. The museums have done provenance research, some more than others, and some better than others. And it does cost a lot of money. So in that respect, I think that there could be some sympathy for the museums, especially in today's economic climate. But to allow that to trump the vast injustice that we're faced with is tragic. I was recently at a presentation that was given by Howard Spiegler, who's going to be our keynote speaker at a function that's co-sponsored by the Cardozo School of Law, the American Society of International Law, Art and Cultural Heritage Interest Group, and others who were very helpful in coordinating it, and he quoted a rabbi Singer, and Rabbi Singer had given a testimonial that that I read about a number of years ago. But when I heard Howard relay it, it just really hit home with me. And what Rabbi Israel Singer, who was the leader of the World Jewish Congress, had stated was, Himmler said, "You have to kill all the Jews, because if you don't kill them, their grandchildren will ask for their property back." And if we just let things lie where they are, then those who trafficked and those who profiteered during the war are allowed to benefit from this. And the United States, we fought a war to stop the Nazis. During that war, we issued the London Declaration on January 5th, 1943, wherein the United States government said that we would do everything that we could, essentially. I shouldn't paraphrase, because I don't want my words to be taken as exaggerating what the commitment was. So if I can just quote a little bit here at first, United States and the Allies warned against looting by, and I'll open the quote, declare, and I changed E to ING, so declaring, and here's the rest of the quote, invalid any transfers of or dealings with property, whether such transfers or dealings have taken the form of open looting or plunder, or of transactions apparently legal in form, even when they purport to be voluntarily effected. So we said that they were invalid. Then we had the Monuments Men, who were in the press a lot lately, and their function was to protect cultural property through during the war. And then after the war, they were instrumental in setting up these huge collection points and assembling all of the stolen art, which the Nazis had hoarded in various locations, as much as they could, because a lot of it also was stolen and then leaked out in various channels as well. And then when we turned to the Marshall Plan, and we had independent nations set up with their own governments, we then had to turn to what we called external restitution, so that the individual countries would then have the obligation to find the owners and return it. And we had a massive failure in that respect, because it just didn't happen. And I understand that after the war, things were, you know, a complete mess, and it was rubble, and countries and people were devastated. But we did have that commitment. And then we had Ardelia Hall, who was just a renowned researcher and I don't even know how to describe her, but a powerhouse in the State Department's Fine Arts and Monuments office. She was an advisor. And she issued a statement on August 27th, 1951, in the Department of State Bulletin, and it said, for the first time in history, restitution may be expected to continue for as long as works of art are known to have been plundered during a war continue to be rediscovered. We had our executive branch and the army seizing thousands and thousands of objects that had been stolen and taken out of Europe and that made their way back into the country. We had some lawsuits filed over time as well, and now we have the executive branch seizing things once again. The success of this depends on the museums. So in the past, I think I was a little bit cautious about being too critical because the ability to actually get the information about where paintings came from lies in cooperation from the museums. And there are plenty of other actors as well. I'm sure the museums feel like they're being singled out. But the museums are the ones that people look to exercise leadership when it comes to what should happen here. And when they are going to court and using a wing of the United States government, our courts, to shut down claims in violation of the Washington Principles and the Terezin Declaration, which the United States was fundamental in forging 44 nations for the Washington Principles and 46 nations as to the Terezin Declaration to sign. It's an embarrassment to the United States, and it hurts our ability to actually lead in this area in order to tell Russia and other countries you really should restitute this property.
We have a caller here, another person who's listening in the community of Belgium, and it's not too far away, on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Mm-hmm. I think I'd like to open up another small can of worms for your guest, Mr. Inge. You have not spoken one word about the literal rape of many cultures throughout history by the United States. When we take pre-Columbian art, pharaonic art, Indonesian art, African art, arts that are dealt with the indigenous people of the United States, which not only were their art objects, but they were part of their culture and their belief system. And these things have been taken. Very few people say anything about that.
Well, I have actually spoken about that in the past, just recently, and I've also written some articles about those issues as well. They raise some similar issues and also different issues. In terms of the ability to own that kind of property, It's actually a pretty complex can of worms, and I don't know that we actually have enough time to.
Well, that would be good. You know, maybe we say sometime we could talk another hour about just about antiquities.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
As another issue, and I don't know if there's any. What are some of the maybe outstanding differences between that and what we're talking about? I suppose one would be establishing ownership, and then in one case you can say, yes, indeed, we have individuals we know own these pieces, and maybe it's a different matter where you're saying that this is cultural patrimony, that it's owned by a country, and then maybe the question would be, well, who brings the claim, and how do you resolve this? Do you resolve this government to government? You know, how exactly do you do that?
Well, a few of the key differences, and again, I'm going to focus somewhat more on the legal aspects because that is my specialty. But and again, law doesn't always fit this well. But a few of the differences hinge on executive policy. When it comes to Holocaust art, we have executive policy going back to 1943 that favors restitution. When it comes to antiquities, we have a patchwork. And when it comes to certain antiquities taken from certain countries, we have bilateral treaties in place, and then we may even have some statutes on the books that say what can be possessed and what cannot be traded. And then when it comes to Native American tribes, we have the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, NAGPRA, which calls for museums to create inventories and then allows for some restitution as well. There's plenty of room to criticize the antiquities collection practices in this country and elsewhere, just as there's plenty of room to criticize the Ask No Questions type of collecting of paintings that's gone on for quite a long time. I think that the market right now is different than it's been before. I think that people who are buying art at this point know they can ask, they can't get away with asking no questions. And where I differ with a lot of other people is I don't think people should be allowed to get away with ask no questions going back to 1933 either.
Hmm. Well, I appreciate the question that the caller raised. I have one other person I wanted to try to get in here, though. Let me ask you just one other thing, because you've talked earlier about the fact that maybe one of the difficulties here is that from one country to another, the laws are going to be different. Ideas about statute of limitations are different. Certainly some governments have done a better job at responding to this than others. And some people have said, well, we really need to get away from that. And what we really should have is some kind of international commission to deal with this very matter. Certainly people have advocated for that. I think that you've advocated for that. What's the chances of such a thing actually happening?
Well, as an academic, I can write as an academic about the way I think the world should be. I think as a political reality, I don't think we're there. And I think that's really unfortunate. I did just have a conversation with somebody about an article that I have coming out soon that talks about creating a domestic title registry effectively so that we could get more information out in the open. And I think that on the collector's side, I think that the only way that will fly if there is some sort of repose, if property is possessed for a certain amount of time that they get title. And I think that could be an insurmountable battle between those who are pro-restitution and those who find themselves more on the pro-market side, although that's somewhat of an artificial divide. So there is, I think, some potential for reform at the state level. Right now in California, we have a new statute that deals with restitution of art, and the Supreme Court is probably going to have to take a look at it. That says that the statute of limitations doesn't start to tick until the true owner has actual knowledge of where the property is and who the right person is to sue. So instead of allowing people to create constructs of what somebody should have known and could have discovered in searching for a needle in a haystack, which is what it amounts to when we talk about what survivors should have done after the war to find their property, that the statute of limitations won't run until somebody has actual knowledge of where that painting is and who to sue. Mm-hmm. So if that statute is upheld at the Supreme Court level, I see potential for that to gain some momentum in other states, especially states with large art markets, is my hope.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Herrick. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. I've got a question about abandonment. In Illinois, if you were to, say, load up your wagon with some of your possessions from your home and leave with no intention of defending your home, the items left behind would be considered abandoned and thus open to whoever might want to take them. How does that work on the international scene? And I'll hang up and listen on the radio. Thank you.
Okay. Well, when it comes to Holocaust victims and their heirs, there are court cases, and there's other legal doctrine that says that the doctrine of abandonment does not apply. They were forced out of their homes. They were persecuted. This isn't an issue of voluntarily leaving property behind. In one instance, for example, this was in Holland. The Nazis, in this legally formalistic way, left a receipt for property that they took from the apartment, saying that they were taking it for safekeeping, as if it had been abandoned. And that was a fairly common practice, and that just doesn't hold up as a matter of law.
Hmm. Is it difficult to establish something that was the result of a forced sale? If there was an outright theft is one thing. But if somebody is under pressure to sell, to sell something far below its market value, but it was, under the law of the time, was considered to be a legal sale, and the buyer would argue that the seller did this willingly. How do you deal with a situation like that?
Well, our government did deal with it in the London Declaration and Military Government Law 59, and other allied governments also dealt with it after the war by saying that even if the transactions were purportedly voluntary, that we will still unwind them if, in fact, they were the product of duress. I think one case comes to mind for me in Bacalar versus Vavra. Yes, Bacalar versus Vavra. A man was put into Dachau so that he would be forced to sign a power of attorney, and then his wife, who was outside, would actually be the one left behind to fill out there were receipts, effectively, so that the Nazis could take inventories of people's property and then systematically loot the property, and that a lot of that property and the money that was stolen in that way was used then to send people off to camps and exterminate people, and also to fund the war effort. To claim that that kind of contract is voluntary is just so completely false. And that, I think, to you and I, is a fairly clear instance. Yet we have a court case being fought about who has title to the property. Now, when we go back to 1933, when the Nazis rose to power, March 1933, at that time, the Nazis' platform was all about extermination of Jews and driving them out of the economic life and the cultural life of the country. And you had systematic boycotts, and then you had sporadic boycotts in some places, starting in 1933. And Jews then were shortly thereafter driven out of their professions, and you had crippling flight tax as well for those who wanted to flee. And the idea that this was just business as usual until 1935, when the race laws were passed, is just completely false. So I understand that there may have been some voluntary sales, and I can accept that, and I do accept that. But to try to say that all Jews, even until 1935, were free to engage in commercial transactions as they wished is just completely false. And one of the museums, in their complaint, effectively alleged just that as to one transaction that was at issue. I'm not sure if I could put my finger on it right now, but there was a statement that of course, the claimants here were absolutely free to engage in free commercial transactions, and that's just not the environment that these persecuted people found themselves in.
Well, and I think also the people who would be making those claims were actually have a very detailed historical record, to draw on, because the Nazi regime, they pretty much said, this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it, and kept fairly careful records about what they were doing all the way along, and a tremendous amount of that material has actually survived.
Yes. The ironic thing is, if the Nazis took your property, you're in a better position to get it back because you're more likely to have documentation. Mm-hmm. If somebody just stole it, or if you entered into a transaction with somebody else, rather than having your property Aryanized, systematically looted, you're less likely to have documentation.
Are there other countries, are other particular countries that you would say really stand out, deserving recognition for the way that they've dealt with these issues?
Well, the United Kingdom has set up a commission. The Spoliation Advisory Commission, which advises the government on on which objects should be returned in the face of claims. And although I may not agree 100% with absolutely every decision that's come down, I think that it establishes a good pattern for us to potentially attempt to replicate if we are to create a commission in this country. Now, the future of a commission here, I don't know what's going to happen. I do know that at meetings that I've attended, that the State Department, at least as of the last information that I had access to, that the plan was to create two wings. One was a voluntary, so not compulsory jurisdiction, but a voluntary wing that would resolve claims. And when a claimant came forward, if the defendant, the possessor, agreed to go to that venue in order to resolve the claim, then it would be able to act. And then the other wing would actually conduct research. And I'm hopeful that something like that can be successful. What I'm fearful of is that given that the museums have been willing to use our courts to shut down claims, I'm fearful that they will hinder the operation of the commission.
We will leave it at that, and again, promise that if you're interested in hearing more on this subject, provided we haven't worn you out, you can go to the Spurlock Museum tonight, 7 o'clock. This takes place in the Knight Auditorium, and the museum is at 600 South Gregory. 7 o'clock, free and open to anybody who would like to attend. Our guest, Jennifer Crater, Associate Professor of Law at Northern Kentucky University, will be talking on this topic, Nazi-looted art and U.S. museums. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David, and thank you those for listening.
All right.